Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See TNCs. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Save big on your landscaping project now at Menards. We make it easy for you to enhance your outdoor living space with the largest in-stock selection of concrete landscape block ready to take home today. Build a fire pit or retaining wall with our tumbled Belgian wall blocks. On sale now. Save big on your landscaping project at Menards. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big money
at Menards. Today, I'm speaking with Dr. Joni Johnston, an acclaimed criminal and forensic psychologist who's an expert in evaluating the insanity defense. In this conversation today, I want to know what we don't know. What does everybody get wrong about the insanity defense? What does everyone get wrong about mental illness in the legal system? Dr. Johnston's insight in this context is remarkable, and I hope you enjoy this conversation. So, Dr. Johnston, I thought it might be helpful if we maybe start with a definition of the insanity defense, because that's changed over time. So, could you give our audience a framework for understanding it?
Yeah, well, first of all, it varies from state to state. So, different states have different laws or different standards for evaluating, you know, really what's kind of called criminal responsibility, which we think of as the insanity plea. Like in California, is the McNaughton rule, which means that in order to be found legally insane, you have to either, you know, not know that what you were doing was wrong or not really appreciate that what you were doing was wrong. So there's got to be a severe mental illness there. There's got to be obviously some mental illness, but that's not enough. And I think people sometimes think it's the diagnosis, which is, you know, as opposed to there has to be this connection between the person's symptoms and their illness and the conduct that they've been accused of as criminal.
So kind of on that basis, fundamentally, I think what the court is looking for, at least kind of in the traditional sense, is the idea that you cannot appreciate the wrongfulness of your actions so that you're under some sort of, you know, you think your victim is a werewolf or something along that lines, but you truly believe it. You truly have this belief that what you're doing is not wrong. Is that right?
That's exactly it. You know, it's kind of saying basically that, you know, we need to be held accountable for behaviors that we understand and appreciate are wrong in our society. And I think that's the confusing part oftentimes for a lot of people who are looking at different cases, particularly if there seems to be some kind of, you know, quote, premeditation. You know, people will kind of go, okay, well, clearly this person is premeditated, this person left the scene afterwards. And those are all facts that come in as part of the evidence. But none of those in and of themselves means that the person is culpable. So for example, there was a case where a man believed his neighbor was sending him these messages and torturing him in his house. And it was, you know, he went over there just like you and I would do if, you know, somebody was playing the music too loud. We'd go over there and say, would you please turn the music down? Would you please quit doing this? And he did this, so called the police several times, you know, and said, you know, that my neighbor is torturing me, basically. And of course, police went over and it was obvious that there was nothing going on. And I'm sure they suggested the person get help. And, you know, fast forward several months and the person ends up seriously assaulting this individual because he felt like he had exhausted every possible, you know, rational kind of avenue. He just kind of, so this is somebody who I think would have understood he's taken all these steps in his mind to try to get the situation resolved. Now, you know, you and I know that these are not rational beliefs. There was nothing going on, but that's separate in a way from what this person truly believed was happening. So this is somebody who, again, took all these steps and ended up, you know, intentionally going over, planning to go over there, and had threatened the person that if this continues to happen, I'm going to do this. I mean, so you look at this and kind of go, here's premeditation. I mean, this guy's basically saying, if this doesn't stop, I'm going to do A, B, and C. And yet his reasoning was based on this delusion he had, you know, that he was being persecuted intentionally by his neighbor.
So that's kind of an easy and classic way to understand the insanity defense, I would think, in that if you are not perceiving reality properly, if you are suffering from delusions, hallucinations, in that you cannot appreciate that what you're doing is illegal, wrong, morally, ethically, you are not responsible. But I think what's going on now in contemporary court cases, and I would love your opinion on this, is that that idea is expanding as we understand more about neurobiology. And so now we're seeing cases like Luigi Mangione, who is pleading emotional disturbance, or cases in which people are saying the condition of their mind at that time wasn't just that they didn't appreciate, maybe they did appreciate the wrongfulness of their actions, but they couldn't control what they were doing because of kind of a deeper neurological sense.
Yeah. And I mean, I think a couple of things to think about with that is that there's a lot of fear oftentimes associated. I mean, people can plead anything they want to. In other words, a defense attorney can be very creative in coming up with a defense that may or may not have validity, at least to a jury. Let's just say that. So there's always been cases, right, where people have said it was because of this, was because of this. We've had some, you know, some extreme cases and examples of those kinds of things. You know, some of the things you're describing, like the irresistible impulse, is not new. I mean, that's kind of been around, and that we've kind of gone backwards. So since John Hinckley was found not guilty of reason of insanity, you probably are aware of this, but we've really kind of reversed a lot of the ideas in terms of the law has been much stricter around insanity pleas. You know, I think it's 7 or 8 states now don't even have an insanity plea as an option. So we've really seen, I mean, even though it looks like you can point to some cases and kind of go, okay, now people are saying I have, I'm a psychopath and I have something wrong with my brain, right? I mean, there's been cases where people, personality disorders, those are things that juries don't typically, I've never heard of a case where somebody's been successful with that kind of a plea. So in reality, we can, you know, again, there's lots of cases. And as our understanding of mental health moves forwards, things will change. I don't know in what direction they will change, but we do know that juries in general do not like the insanity plea.
What do you think in terms, like, are we getting this right? And you mentioned psychopathy and serial killers. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's that infamous anecdote from the Jeffrey Dahmer trial where his defense attorney says, you know, if you can eat people and kidnap and eat people you don't know and you're still not insane, like, who is insane? So there is kind of this argument going on. So are we getting it right? Should the definition be expanded? Should we look at it differently?
I don't think that somebody's conduct should ever be the criteria for whether they are legally insane or not. And that's not the intent. We have all known, I mean, I have worked in a maximum security prison. I talk to inmates almost every day. And I've seen some people who do horrendous things. And, you know, it has nothing to do with mental health or mental illness. So, yeah, I don't think that, I mean, I understand why a defense attorney might say that. But again, I don't think that just because somebody has done something horrible should expand our definition of, you know, what insanity is. It is the, you know, when we're talking about insanity, the as you pointed out, the point behind it is to not hold people criminally responsible for things that they don't have control over. And to have a severe mental illness is something people don't have control over. You know, it's certainly when they're actively symptomatic. So I don't think I would not be somebody who would ever argue that we should base an insanity that we should base a successful insanity plea based on the conduct and how bizarre it was or how severe it was or those kinds of things.
I would imagine you do encounter cases or have encountered cases in which a person has done something because of a mental illness, let's say something like depression, where there isn't necessarily psychotic features. They're not necessarily hallucinating. But perhaps they are delusional based on kind of the tunnel vision they have or the over and you know, to go even further, they are seeing the world the wrong way because their neurochemicals are off balance, right? You know, can you apply the insanity defense in that, or is there a line there? Like, how do you make that distinction?
Well, you know, it's interesting because that's when you say
Hey, it's Ryan Seacrest here. And if you're looking for some serious fun, head over to ChumbaCasino.com. At Chumba Casino, you can play all your favorite social casino-style games for free anytime, anywhere. It's the most fun you can have on your phone or computer.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
Can you? Mm-hmm. What does that mean? You know, in other words, a defense attorney can argue that, mm-hmm. you know, can plead insanity, and that's going to be part of that argument. You know, when I go in and evaluate somebody, you know, I do pretty much the same. Most of my cases, luckily for me, are court ordered. So I'm kind of the neutral party to go in. And that's what I prefer, because it just makes it cleaner. So I go in and do the same thing that I would do if I was testifying for the prosecution or the defense, which I will end up doing based on, I guess, who likes, you know, what I have to say. But I'm a court, appointed person. You know, I'm going to be, again, always looking, number one, does this person have a severe mental illness? So let's say major depression. Right. What does that mean for this? So that's the first thing I have to say. What does that mean for this particular person in terms of major depression? Has this person been diagnosed with that? Has this person been diagnosed with that in the past? What symptoms does this person have? How is it impacting this person's functioning? How was it impacting this person's functioning at the time that they were, you know, that they committed this crime? You know, it becomes a little bit harder, right? When you're talking about, okay, the person, a narrowing of focus is different from a delusion. Mm-hmm. So I might believe that my options are limited in terms of, you know, my life is so horrible. I can't see past this tunnel that I'm in. It's always going to be this way. I mean, some of the things people, you know, I've always felt this way. I'm always going to feel this way. My life is over and those kinds of things. I mean, that might be part of the fact pattern. But for me, again, I'm going to have to say, okay, that's number one. You know, what was it like for this person at this point in time? Who knew this? Who else saw this? I'm always going to be talking to family members or friends or coworkers. I mean, you always want to corroborate information, not just the person's telling you that, but other people are seeing what this person is saying. And then it becomes, again, okay, how does this relate to hurting somebody else? Mm-hmm. Because, you know, my first thought, and this is just preliminary, would be that would go along much more with hurting myself. Right. If I'm in this depression and my options are narrow and those kinds of things. So how does that translate into deciding to hurt, you know, hurting somebody else? And it, you know, I'm not saying that connection can't be made, but I'm going to need to clearly see how that narrowing of focus led to this person hurting somebody else mm-hmm. or committing a crime. I keep saying violent, but it doesn't have to be violent. It can be trespassing or you know, in any crime you could plead not guilty by reason of insanity. Right. So that's going to be the issue, you know. And of course, you know, I may do an evaluation and say, yeah, this person was depressed. This person had been depressed for, you know, for years, or they've gone through periods, and I don't see a connection between this person's depression and, you know, and their. Or maybe there's a connection, but they legally could understand and appreciate that what they were doing was wrong. Mm-hmm. Maybe they didn't care. I don't care about my life anymore because I'm so depressed. That's not the same thing. Is not seeing, you know, is there being a direct connection between that depression and those thoughts and doing something harmful to somebody else.
Yeah, I see. I see what you're saying. That's such an interesting evaluation. Do you get a lot of people when you're doing these evaluations? Do you see a lot of people attempting to fake the insanity defense?
I wouldn't say a lot of people try to fake it. I mean, certainly it happens, and we have some pretty good ways of, you know. I don't want to say catching it. And that's kind of the first, I'll say that because it's the first thing that kind of popped in my head. We have some ways of evaluating it. You know, it's interesting because most people, I think, they're obviously faking it in the way that they think it's supposed to look. Mm-hmm. And so we have some relatively sophisticated ways of trying to see if somebody really is faking. Of course, one of the things too is history. I mean, the vast, vast majority of individuals who successfully plead not guilty, a reason of insanity, have an extensive history of mental health problems long before the criminal act. And that's something you would kind of expect to see if somebody has a severe mental illness. Now, occasionally I see, and I'm thinking of one case I saw where it was the person's first real psychotic break. They had a history of bipolar disorder already, but they had never been as manic as they were. So this was the first time this person got in trouble. And I legitimately believed this person was not criminally responsible. And luckily, and this is the other thing people, I think sometimes it's because we don't ever see these cases, is the prosecutor and the defense agreed that this person was legally insane. There was never a disagreement about that. So the case just got adjudicated in that way. That tends to happen more often than not because
oh,
of
really?
The fact that, because I'll tell you why, because it's not, you know, less than 1% of defendants plead insanity. And less than a quarter of those are successful. So it's not, I mean, you know, a lot of people will say it's a Hail Mary in some respects, even if it's legitimate, because there have been plenty of jurors who've said after the fact, you know, I really thought this person was really, really, you know, insane, basically, but I don't want this person out.
That is really insightful, because you're saying we're talking about 0.25% of all cases. And
yes.
I think most people are making, you know, most people are understanding the insanity defense based on these huge cases they see in the media, which are extreme outliers of the insanity defense. And that is refreshing to hear that prosecutors and defense attorneys often work together when they are convinced that a mental health issue is appropriate and insanity is driving the defense. Because I think I certainly, I'm on the outside looking in, but I certainly have the impression of the American justice system that it's very adversarial all the time. But you're saying there are these instances where prosecutors and defense attorneys come together and appreciate what is happening and just kind of try and get the case through the courts to seek the truth. Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely. I mean, there's such a high bar of success that if you're a defense attorney, you know, you know this. And again, you're going to be pleading that insanity. I mean, again, I'm not saying it isn't used as a Hail Mary sometimes, because it is, right? Mm-hmm. If the person is caught doing something, you have very limited options. So that can happen. I'm not saying that. But what I am saying is that particularly people who are successful is that you have a defense attorney and the behavior is so clear in terms of, you know, it's oftentimes so bizarre and so clear. And there's this history before that. There's a history around that time, other people documenting it. And, you know, it's just clear to everybody involved what happened. And it's horrible. It's just a tragedy all the way around. And yet if you're a prosecutor or a defense attorney, I mean, how does that benefit anybody to put someone in prison who had no understanding of what they were doing at the time? And the other thing is, you know, we know statistically you're more likely to spend a longer amount of time in a forensic hospital than you are in prison.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's not like, I think sometimes people get afraid that if I find this person legally insane, I'm going to see him on the bus, you know, in 6 months. That's not likely to happen at all. So, you know, I mean, there are a lot of, I think, fears around the insanity plea. And I understand that because like you were saying, we hear about the high profile cases, we hear about, you know, serial killers who are pleading insanity and, you know, that people are terrified about that. And so it's a scary thing to think about. We don't see the fact that the person, if they are found not guilty, they're going to be, you know, Andrea Yates is still in a forensic hospital.
Yeah. In Austin. I think the thing with serial killers, like you say, and maybe this is a good place to leave it, but I think serial killers are insane. You know, I don't think you can be a serial killer without being insane, in some, depending how you make that definition. But, you know, if you're a person who is gratified by sadistic, violent sex and goes out and targets strangers you don't, you know, people you don't know and kills them and you know, does whatever for your own sexual gratification, and you do this over and over and over again for a period of years, I mean that is insane. But I'm not saying they shouldn't be found guilty or that the law should excuse that. I just think it raises a bigger question as to, you know, how we even view intent, responsibility, in as we understand more about the mind, as we learn more about the mind.
Well, I definitely think, obviously, you know, psychology to me is such a fascinating topic, and we're always learning and trying to, you know, understand, you know, how we think and why we make the choices that we do. But I would, again, just say, in kind of wrapping things up, that, you know, I've seen people who are very, very sane do really bad things. And I don't think you have to have something mentally wrong with you to do it. That sounds pessimistic, because I'm actually basically an optimist, because I see people all the time who do amazing things, given, you know, which is extraordinary given some of their start in life. But I think that this link between mental illness and violence, I think, has been really, in some respects, exaggerated.
Oh, really?
I do, by That's the media. Really, and the first time, you know, whenever we see somebody who does something violent, the first thing is, oh, it must be mental illness. And, you know, again, when you look at the research, who are people with severe mental illnesses likely to hurt themselves?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, far more often than they are. They're more likely to be victims of crime. So there's a link between mental illness and violence, but it's not the way I think most of us think it is.
Yeah, I think what I'm thinking about is, and I totally hear what you're saying, I don't think we can blame mental illness as a catch-all to explain violent crime. Mm-hmm. But when we, you know, in modern research, when we look at, and I'm talking about like how people make decisions. For example, there's a great research study in which they looked at judges before and after lunch on parole cases. And they found that, you know, people were 80% or something, or it was a very, very high number. I'm definitely not quoting it properly, and I'll try and find the study for our viewers. But it was the consensus of the study was that you were way, way more likely to get parole after lunch because the judges have eaten, so their blood sugar is higher. And it is part of the ongoing research that shows that the things we do are often out of our control, even though we perceive them to be within our control.
Yeah.
And that, to me, really brings into question the whole shape of the justice system and what we're talking about when we're talking about mental health and insanity.
That's an interesting, I think, observation on your part. And I think it, you know, there's obviously so many possible ways to go with all of this research. I would also say that, you know, if that's true, though, we would expect all of us to be, you know, why is it that we so often don't commit crimes, and that we so often don't act on impulse or feelings, or, you know, I mean, so I think it's complicated. And I think we're always looking for that balance between accountability and understanding. And that's a hard one.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you, Dr. Johnson. This is great.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.